If I go past 12:15, someone come up and tell me, okay? Don't just get up and walk out. Jerry said it's 12:15. Okay, just for that, I'm going to give the other sermon. Oh. I was reading a story about a Virginia textbook, history textbook, used in public schools. And it told a very powerful story about the Civil War, in which toward the end, slaves were freed in order to fight for the South, and they formed a regiment and fought for the Confederacy. It's a very interesting story. Unfortunately, it's not true. There were virtually no African Americans that fought in the Civil War on behalf of the South. It was garnered for that textbook from a website. I guess you guys know, because I barely understand this stuff, I really do, that there's some huge percentage of people under some age, that doesn't include me, that gets most of their news from Twitter. Or from Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram. Thank you, Instagram. I'm on none of them, so chose one. So it was from a website, from the Sons of the Confederacy, and it had that story. There are other histories that are going around. One of them is that slaves often had positive relationships in the American South with their masters, with their owners. We talk about house slaves and the non-house slaves, that there was a loyalty to them. Let's say we see in Gone with the Wind, not exactly a history text, where there was a great deal of loyalty between on behalf of the slaves toward the masters and the children they helped to raise. There is a saying in this alternative Southern history that blacks liked segregation because, as we all know from the high school cafeteria, blacks like to be with blacks. And it's not our doing, it's their choice. This is often called the lost cause narrative. It says that the Civil War was not really about slavery. It was actually about states' rights, and that there was a special culture of the South that was largely pro-slavery, and that this has been diminished and devalued by our overly liberal Northern victorious read and retelling of history. The only problem with this narrative is, as I said, it's not historically true. Actually, as Abraham Lincoln made clear, the Civil War was about slavery. It was about keeping America together. It was about eliminating slavery. Not all people in the Confederacy thought slavery was right. Most Northerners knew it was wrong. There were virtually no African Americans that fought on behalf of the Confederacy. There were virtually no African American slaves who decided that their loyalty to their white masters was a higher sense of moral justice than the fact that they had been enslaved. The real history is that the last census done prior to the Civil War is that 1 in 7 people in this country was owned by someone else. We can look around this sanctuary and imagine 1 in 7 people in America were owned by someone else. In the state of Virginia, when the Civil War started, 1 in 3, 1 in 3 people was owned by another. Let's remember that in that ownership, there was no sense of the right to get married, right? If slaves had children, masters generally liked that because they had more people to sell, and they broke up families willy-nilly. There was very little Southern honor in it, and that is and as well the fact that, let's be honest, female slaves were considered the sexual property of their masters, and rape, including underage rape, was rampant, as we know, because of miscegenation, because of the gene test that we do now. That was the real story of slavery and not a fake one. I look at the people who are protesting and who are, I look at the rise of anti-Semitism and Nazism and neo-Nazism in this country. And I could give you a very successful sermon and get a pat on my back at the end of the day if I just say, oi, it's back. How did it come back? Everyone hates the Jews. No one understands. We all have to be more vigilant about anti-Semitism, and if only people understood. But that's a little bit of the easy way out. Where is it coming from? I want to understand it. And I think I do. I think I understand a piece of it. And this is the piece I understand. Do you know the origin of the 10 drops of wine for the plagues that we do at the Seder? Boom, boom, boom. If you have a nice, sweet, kind, compassionate rabbi like me, I say we diminish our wine cup drop by drop because we don't want to celebrate the misfortune of others. I like that midrash. The only problem is that's not really the origin of the 10 drops of wine at the Seder. They were 10 curses upon the people who are perpetrating injustice in the world today. Kind of makes good sense in a Seder. Doesn't that make sense? This wasn't just something that happened a long time ago, kids. This is something that we are out there fighting. And, you know, and so even this, for those who grew up in certain Sephardic countries, they may, like Iraq and Yemen, you may actually, or Tunisia, you may actually remember in your family the tradition where you would take those 10, you would take the 10 drops you collected and you would go to the anti-Semites at the town and you would throw a little bit of the wine on their front yard or on their doorpost, and it was your way of cursing them because they're still an anti-Semite and they're still doing it today. So what does that teach me about skinheads? I hope I remember. No, I'm gonna just take it. What it teaches me about skinheads is when you see no justice around you in society, it makes you angry, right? When you see the way in just 50 or 60 years, the financial sector of this economy has gone from a small piece, remember the days of going to the bank with the checkbook, to basically these kinds of self-sustaining investment something or others, where it's now a huge sector of the economy. And then when somehow using things like derivatives and things we don't understand, they pretty much collapse the economy, everyone gets off scot-free, and pretty much no one is punished, and the taxpayer picks up the tab. That's not just. When they see the jobs are moved to other countries where they don't have any environmental regulations, so they can pollute the whole world, which eventually comes back on us, and so they can produce goods cheaper than we can, and so we lose our jobs here, that's not just. When they see the division between rich and poor in this country get larger and larger and larger, to the people that I grew up thinking of as rich don't even count as rich anymore. So if you thought you were rich, I'm sorry to say you probably aren't compared to like the 1% anymore. So join the rest of us in the bottom 99. When you see, I mean, I'm thinking of the Torah. You know, the Torah talks about judges being impartial. And in most of Deuteronomy, Parshat Shoftim, and on, it goes, you have to trust your legislators and the people who are governing that they really will implement things like, you know, with the authority that you bestow on them and not cheat. And how many years have we gone on now with between the gerrymandering so that all the seats are safe and elections don't barely matter anymore and throws us all to the right and the crazy left? And the lobbyist money and lobbyists run, you know, writing legislation to give tax breaks to large corporations while the poor get poorer, poorer, and poorer, and we're told there's no money for anything anymore. We got to cut that program. There's no money for environmental protection. Here we are in California, and all I know about my principal, I don't know anything about my Poway principal of my elementary school, about her educational philosophy, but I do know that she raises money every single week. I get like an email every 3 days. They need money, they need money, and it gets me all angry, and then they say, but, you know, there's no money in California for education. We have one of the lowest spending per pupil in the country. And so, you know, I write my check and I do what I got to do. I feel for them, but there's no money anymore. And I want, yes, there's money. It's just not going to people who need it. And when there's no justice anymore, people get angry and they curse. One of the things I do in this congregation is when I pass by memorial plaques, and when I open a book and I see who dedicated it, and when I look at the back of a chair and I see a name, I do zichronot. I have their memories hit me in the head, and something about them teach me today. So when I walk by the front of the congregation and I see Maury Feldman and Gene Feldman's name above that exit sign on the other side when you walked up, I think about Maury. Olav HaShalom. Maury was a World War II veteran. And he actually, at his funeral, multiple people showed up from the government in high-level positions. Apparently, he was in intelligence, but we're not supposed to talk about it. And he did a lot of work in Germany after World War II, where he fought. And when it was getting time for Maury to die, he wasn't happy with me. And he said, and I want a military funeral at Miramar, and I don't care if I'm Jewish anymore. I'm certainly not going to leave a legacy to a synagogue. And he left money to the Monarch School for Homeless Children and to JFS. He said, if synagogue's just about services, I'm too old to see the point. He said, when I fought in World War II, I fought for something else. And when I look around, I see that where's the something else? Where's the fight that we were fighting for? Where's the combination of America and Judaism that defined my life? When I don't see that around, my heart sinks. I think of a popular article published in the New York Times recently by Nathan Englander, the writer, who's giving or gave speeches here in San Diego. And he wrote, basically, I can't believe what I'm seeing on the streets. When we grew up with anti-Semitism, when I know I didn't, but when my parents and grandparents were beaten up for being Jewish in Philadelphia, New York, and Baltimore, and Chicago, all the places that we grew up, that they couldn't believe that there would come a time where that could happen again, where people are shouted at in Target for being Jewish. You know, there's a report from a friend of mine that a friend of his, his little daughter had come from Tat Shabbat and was singing Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat Shalom, and a strange couple with a child started to taunt them and follow them to their car and say kike and Jew, and we don't need another Jew in the world, we're going to do stuff like that. I mean, you know, basically the skinheads that are around us. Yet in England, I thought we were done with that. I thought we had gotten through that. And so this is my thesis for today. Those people need to lie about American history, because the story of America is a different story than the story they're telling. And I think that they may even, through their anger and their need to blame someone for the fact that society is just heading toward this dystopian separation between the haves and the have-nots, that they may even have forgotten our history. And I wonder if we Jews have forgotten our history. Because when you don't remember the story that you are a part of, then the only story you have, the only value you have, is survival. When you don't remember the history, the story of that history, the purpose in that history, then all you've got left is an ethic of survival. Obviously, when you have a country in which 40 years ago, over 80% of Americans were white Christians, and today that's 43%. You have people who, when they think of their survival, think of white Christian. And everyone else is the problem. Interestingly, the story of America is, in a lot of ways, was taken from, when anything's good, where is it taken from? It's from us. Okay, that was an easy answer. Okay. when the pilgrims came over, and yes, they were imperfect. They were fleeing the Anglican Church and the oppression of national religion, of institutional religion, because they couldn't live according to freedom of conscience. And the colonies in this country actually each used to have their own religion. They also didn't like the other. You know, there was the Methodist state. I grew up in the Quaker state, so we got all you beat. I love Quaker. So Pennsylvania, right, Dutch and German. So each state actually had its own religion. And there was a sense of the freedom of religion in this country. Their favorite things to celebrate the pilgrims were kind of like their narrative. The story they thought they were a part of was the Exodus story. And they thought they were leaving the land of tyranny, and they thought they could start a new world with a holy society in which freedoms were protected. And yes, they didn't do a perfect job. But then we had the founding fathers in the 1700s. The founding fathers believed in a country in which religion didn't dominate. And they were open to any, and they also, by the way, you know, the pilgrims, I'm never sure it's entirely true, so if it's not true, it's really bad if I use it in a sermon about telling the historical truth. But those tell me that Thanksgiving was part of them celebrating the Exodus story of when you get out of, when you cross into freedom and are redeemed, you live in your Sukkot, and you thank God for your blessings of gratitude, which is one of the reasons that Thanksgiving occurs so close to the holiday of Sukkot. They saw themselves in the Jewish narrative. Who did the African-American slaves, what narrative did they see themselves in this country within slavery? The Jewish narrative of the Exodus, right? They saw themselves as the people that God is going to bring out of slavery and into freedom to build a better society. And what narrative was believed in by Thomas Jefferson and the founding fathers? It was our narrative. It was the Exodus narrative. And you know, today we have this fake history being perpetrated where people say this is a Christian country, right? And it was meant to be all along. And there's a war on Christmas. Just wait till that comes up again this year, all right? Go and make a comeback for sure. Heck, I was down in Poway and there was a big sign on one of the windows. I think it was the bike shop next to over by the Chipotle in Old Poway. And it said something like, we don't believe in the, you know, they said that we're against the war on Christmas. When you come in here, you get a Merry Christmas. Okay, so the narrative, now, you know something about Thomas Jefferson. Let's get away from the fake history and let's get back to the real history. Thomas Jefferson did something incredibly radical. He built the University of Virginia with no chapel, and he did it on purpose. According to historians, it was possibly the first university built in the Western world in maybe over 1,000 years that had no chapel. He also published a version of the New Testament that took out all the miracles, and he felt strongly that in America, education and civic public society should be ruled only by moral conscience, and that a solid education would lead anyone, hopefully, to a sense of civic duty and moral conscience. And he wanted organized religion out of it. Now, I like organized religion, but I love Thomas Jefferson. I don't think there was a war on Christmas Thomas Jefferson would support. That's the true story of this country. It was the story that Morey Feldman fought in the war for, and many of our grandparents or yourselves fought in, which is the war where we went to fight Nazis, and we went in a unit with people who were black and people who were Jewish, and and they all bonded together, and Americans and poor. And back then there was a draft, so it was wealthier. We stopped that in Vietnam. In Vietnam, rich kids didn't go anymore to war, but back in World War II, it still was known to happen. And everyone was mixed together, fighting together. And it was the story of America. And it was fighting tyranny. And I understand when Maury comes home and says, what the heck has happened to this country? When you're part of the story, and when you realize where you are in the story, you have the purpose that Maury felt. And you have to know the real history. I got another historical factoid for you. Do you know the conservative movement wasn't always named the conservative movement? In the 19th century, it had a different name, and it got changed because it was considered too philosophical. I want to go back to the original name. Probably only three people in the room know what it was. It was created by German philosophers along with Orthodoxy and Reform in Germany in the 1830s. It was called the Positive Historical School. It was called Positive Historical Judaism. Positive Historical Judaism. And its argument was that you have to know your history accurately, and then you will take that history and its mission positively out into the world and deposit it. They love the word posit. To think it, to put it, to have it come alive. You feel the call within the history of what the mission is. So let's briefly cover. Well, what is this story? Anyone who comes to services, reads the Torah, comes to Torah study, knows what the story is, which is that society had inequality, and it had violence in Genesis. And God realized that killing bad people and leaving just a couple of good people didn't change anything about the way society functioned. And so God found a guy named Abraham. And God said, Abraham, you're going to create a new society, and it won't be based on land ownership and inequality. It'll be based on being a shepherd and going from place to place and being close to nature and realizing your wealth is in employing as many people as possible and welcoming every stranger into your midst and making covenants of peace wherever you go. And that covenant was passed on, that story, to Moses. And it was about the fact that your history is you were slaves. And you are going to come out from that, and from that experience, you're going to create a new society in which tyranny and inequality have no foothold. And each step of the Torah takes is a piece of that story. It says you're going to be the only society in the world where a runaway slave is given asylum. And not only is a runaway slave given asylum, but they get to live wherever they choose. And that phrase, as I pointed out services recently, is only otherwise used for God. God gets to be in the place that he chooses, as well as the runaway slave. They can live with the poor, they can live with the rich, you're not segregating them. And it's a society that values the people who are different, even if they don't convert to Judaism. So the ger, who the stranger and foreigner who lives among you, is to be valued, and you accept the refugee. And the poor have to have justice. And the judges can't be on the take. As I pointed out recently, do you know what the largest bust of illegal immigrants in this country has ever been? It was Rubashkin's. It was the bust of the Orthodox slaughterhouse in Pottsville, Iowa. And what was unique about that case was 400 illegal immigrants. The standard practice is when they were taken, normally they would be processed and sent out of the country. But the judge did a very strange thing. They actually decided to put them all in jail, which is unusual, unique, and jailed them all. And it came out recently that the same judge had bought stock in the private prison system 5 days earlier. Torah says that's not okay, right? And Shoftim comes around and says, you have to have professional law enforcement, none of this tribal justice stuff. And I think of Sheriff Arpaio, right? Do you know that while he was busy taking anyone who looked Hispanic and rounding them up and building these weird newfangled tent jails in the Arizona summer heat for people to swelter, just one study showed that in just one 3-year period in the late 2000s, because he had put all of his resources into that program, 400 cases of sexual assault went uninvestigated, not without sentence, uninvestigated. In just a 3-year people, 400 sexual assaults, many of children, because he was busy doing that. That's what the Torah says is not okay. And the Torah comes in and it says that society has to put a shield of dignity around anyone who's defenseless, around children who are suffering, around animals who are suffering, around the environment if it's suffering and it's being taken advantage of. And if you're in debt, you may have a hard time, because all of us are in debt one way or another, and that's kind of what slavery was in the Torah. But then your dignity has to be shielded. And even if you are a slave or an indentured servant in the Torah, their master cannot sleep with you, and your master and your marriages are valid, and eventually you have to go free. There has to be a mechanism. Your dignity is shielded by the society. So that's our story. Our story is we're supposed to bring to the world a society in which all of these things happen. But when you don't remember that that's our story, then all you have left is the story that somehow Jews need to survive. And it's about Jewish survival. The rabbis knew that story. They called it the false story of chosenness. We were chosen because we were special and not chosen because we have a mission. We lie about our own history too. Come on. We know we do. We have too much going on in this Jewish world, which is all about culture. It's all about, Judaism is about doing it the right way. And if you do it the right way, then that's the right way. And then I'm better than you because I did it the right way. And I read something, so I know it's the right way. Orthodox culture is just another culture. It's not the right culture versus the wrong culture. It's no better or worse than bagels and lox culture. If you forgot your story. I was a little embarrassed when Marissa and I went to hear the Israeli consul speak eloquently in La Jolla earlier this year. And when the Israeli consul spoke, he talked about what Israel does, how they were one of the first countries to Haiti to help with the disasters that happened there, and that they send people, crisis teams, abroad to help during earthquakes and hurricanes and all kinds of tragedies that go on. And of course, there's one table of Jews, all with their tzitzits hanging out. And when it was their turn to ask their question, he got up and he said, representing his table, my question is, so there aren't Jews you could be helping instead? There are no Jews that could use some help? I can probably find you some Jews that could use some help. And he sat back down. That was a little bit better than when the Israeli consul came 2 years earlier and it was a rabbi's only meeting. And when that table got their chance to ask a question, they stood up and they said, what I don't understand is why you don't talk about the fact that all the Arabs are dogs and they need to be rounded up and put on buses and taken to a border somewhere. And the Israeli consul just looked at them, and this is a very right-wing Israeli consul, and was like, I'll pass that along. And it's the same thing we do when we say all this anti-Semitism is just about us. And it's just about the fact that we have to fight it because it's anti-Semitism. If we forget, if we think it's only about our survival and it's not about our mission of bringing the world to a different place, then we've forgotten our story. The story that we have is one of hearing the moral authority in the voice of the Torah. And making our story a part of that story in this world. So I want to give you a positive example. I was listening to NPR this year, and they told a story about Panera. It said that Panera has these stores restaurants in very, very poor areas, particularly in Massachusetts and other areas, particularly in the poor sections of Boston and other places. Rhode Island, where there are no other restaurants because it's such a poor area. And you know those kiosks if you go into Panera now? Is this a commercial for Panera? And you have to type in your... I hate that. I like ordering. I don't like having to figure it all out on a computer. Do you know where that originated? So this is where I found out on NPR. It originated in those places. The owner of Panera had this idea that in poor areas that have no restaurants, he would put Paneras. And he would put them exactly like all the other Paneras. They wouldn't have inferior food, right? I can't stand it when someone like walks up to a homeless person, like, here's a $3 gift certificate to McDonald's. If I'm going to go up to a homeless person, I'm going to invite them to eat what I'm eating, right? They don't get worse because they're poor. The Torah's against that, right? So, like, he's a exact same menu, exact same quality, except no waiters or waitresses. I mean, nobody at the cashier. You go in, you order your food, and you type in what you want to pay. And those Paneras exist. Business-wise, so they don't make any money. but they almost break even. Right? No supervision. So what do you think I did? I came home and I was like, that's got to be a Jew. That's got to be a Jew. That's got to be someone who grew up in Hebrew school, like at Neri Tamid, and learned Maimonides' charity thing and realized that it's all about the dignity of the poor person and feeding the poor person and not embarrassing them in any way so anyone could overhear them tell someone, I'm only going to pay $3 for this meal for my family. Because that's just as important as that they get to eat. And it's just as important that they get the food that you would eat. So do you think I was right? Yes, I was. But it has since been sold to a very large corporation that is not Jewish. So it's sold to a multinational corporation, but it was started by Jews. A guy who goes to Israel, bar mitzvahed his kids, there are lots of great, and he gives TED Talks. But it has since been sold. So what I'm trying to say with the positive story is that a guy who grew up in a synagogue like this and understood what the Jewish story was and made it a reality in this world. So when it's their time for their eulogy, I guarantee you that whatever rabbi buries that man is going to be talking about that. Because that is, as Joseph said, the longest saga in all of Genesis is the Joseph story. And at the end, basically, someone comes to him and they say, so when he's reunited with their brothers, they say, tell us everything that happened to you. And he said, my whole story is that I got a chance to save people. And then he shuts up. The longest story, the longest possible eulogy, I got to help people. What Morey Feldman was looking for was a real American history that says that's what this country was built on and that's what the flag stands for. And it doesn't, and when that story is forgotten, that this is a place that can bring in, I don't know how many immigrants we can bring in and how many refugees, but I don't think we need better security checks for refugees when the refugee program that's already been working through its own security program has never let in anybody who basically did a terrorist act. We don't need to make up rules to somehow protect us, because then you have to invent a history that said it was about white Christian people. And white Christian people are facing a crisis right now, whether their story is big enough to include a lot of people who don't look like them. Before this election, 4 out of 5 self-described evangelical white Christians said that the most important quality in a president is personal moral character. That same survey was done by the Pew Institute recently, and it had dropped to 1. So apparently, real personal moral character wasn't what they were after all along. Right? They were after their own survival. They were after their culture being the dominant culture and rewriting a story about our country that says it's about them. And it never was. We as Jews have to open up to the fact that at UCSD, among the Jews there, 1/4 of them are people of color. Our story is not going to be a white story anymore. And it doesn't have to be. I have a feeling that the people who came out of Egypt weren't all white. Do you ever have that feeling too? And our story is big enough to embrace them. When you hear the moral voice of Sinai and you realize that God is the God of history, and you get that history right, you have hope. You don't have the anger anymore. You realize that it's not those people who are to blame, so I can have my island to live on, and I make up a history that's Nordic or whatever this alt-light is making up. And by the way, just so you don't think I'm a bleeding heart lefty, that story is just as, the story of that flag is just as besmirched by the left. When they talk about the fact that our history is just a history of oppression. And yeah, Thomas Jefferson, he slept with his slaves. So we discount him, right? Like when I went to Harvard and I was in one of my special seminars, application only, where a group of women walked in 1992, and they had the stack of books of the syllabus that the professor assigned on the first day. And they said, "Professor, before you start at the Christian Divinity School," they went like this. And they dropped all over the floor. The professor said, "What's going on?" And they said, "We checked the footnotes of the books you assigned us, and fewer than one-third of the footnotes were by women. So none of these books have anything to teach us." That's the radical left that sees everything that's ever happened in America about competition for power. We did it over the Indians, and then this story in history is just about trying to justify this kind of oppression. I'll tell you the greatest definition of tradition I've ever heard. Tradition is making your ancestors smarter than they were. Because Thomas Jefferson may have had Sally Hemings. And I don't want to hear a story about how they really loved each other. I assumed he raped her. I think she was pretty young. I don't know. If you find some love story that proves me wrong, fine. But I don't need to make up a story about that. What I know is that his ideas were better than even his personal practice. And his ideas were part of a story. Did Moses have more than one wife? You know what I mean? Did Abraham more than... I think so. Something, you know, like... But they were part of a story of inclusion and the dignity of every human being and of human rights. We brought those rights to the world as Jews, and they inspired Thomas Jefferson, and they inspired the Pilgrims, and they inspired the African-American slaves to say, what we need to do is rise up and create those rights and dignity for everybody. And it is the reason that Martin Luther King, in a way, won over Malcolm X, who Malcolm X was equally, if not more, brilliant. Because Malcolm X says, we just have to worry about our own survival. And Martin Luther King said, in this country that seems like it's just this leftist, this just oppression and power, there is a beauty that will save us. And it's a beauty that comes from God, and it's in the flag. And it was a crazy idea. And he was right. So, yes, the left is just as bad. There's no idea a man ever came up with that helped a woman, that ever created a system that created rights for women. That's the same wrong story. I'd like you individually to find your place in the Jewish story. And I'd like you to find your nobility in the place, the institution, that you've invested yourself, that you believe has nobility. One of the reasons that I left academia at the end of 40 to become a rabbi is I couldn't find the story anymore in the ivory tower. It was just politics and it was just power. And so I left it. And I went to a place where I find that nobility and I find that purpose. You may find it in being a mother. You may find it in being a teacher. You may find it in being an American. You may find it in being a Jew. You may find it in your profession. You work at a university, or you work with children, or you're in healthcare, and you're making healthcare policy. Never let it fall to the level of this is just a power game of who wins and who loses, because then you've lost your purpose. If you think there's nobility in healthcare, if you think there's nobility in teaching, if you're so silly as you think there's nobility in a synagogue, then don't let anyone change your mind. Find the purpose and seize on that nobility. And your story will be open to, as Joseph said, saving lives and preserving dignity. You won't have to be scapegoating anybody because your heart will be full.